Anybody else that needs one? Remember, we're looking at the kingdom of Saul at this point in time, but of course we're changing and transitioning this evening. If you'll be opening up to 1 Samuel chapter 16, we're transitioning from Saul. We evaluated Saul's reign and his failures the past couple of weeks. And tonight begins the context or the content that is going to be primarily directed toward David and his reign. And of course, in 1 Samuel chapter 16 and 17, we have the very, very early days of David. Not necessarily his reign just yet, but the early days of David. Again, we're looking at the nation of Israel. Gibeah is the capital city at this time. Why is Gibeah the capital city during Saul's reign? That's his home place. That's his hometown. So that is where the capital is at this time. Remember, where is Jerusalem at this time? It's not even known as Jerusalem. David's not going to take Jerusalem until 2 Samuel chapter 4, and he's going to have to take it from the Jebusites. So until that occurs, until David moves the capital to Jerusalem, and that's where the temple would ultimately be built, it's in Gibeah at this time. Now, we've spent a lot of time in this area of Ramah and Mizpah and Gibeah and all of those little cities right through there. And then, of course, we've been in Bethlehem, or we're going to Bethlehem tonight. And then from Bethlehem, we're going to go over here to Azekah and Sokah in that valley of Elah. That's primarily where we're going to be on the maps tonight. Our first question this evening is, summarize Samuel's visit to the house of Jesse. So let's look at the beginning of 1 Samuel chapter 16, and let's just march through the text and just think about everything that's transpiring as Samuel makes his way down to Bethlehem. Now first, chapter 15 ends and chapter 16 begins with Samuel being... How's Samuel feeling at this time? All right, he's mourning over Saul. And it's not just Samuel that's mourning over Saul. You look at the end of chapter 15, look at verse 35. Who else has regretted something? The Lord. Do y'all remember any other time that the Lord regretted something? That's the one that came to my mind, is Genesis chapter 6, where he regretted that he had created man because of the wickedness that man has done. And now here, he's given them the kingdom. They called for it in 1 Samuel chapter 8. He gave that to them. But now at the end of 1 Samuel chapter 15, the Lord is regretting this. But there is something greater in store here. Now, in those first couple of verses, you see the sadness of Samuel, but you also see the Lord coming along and saying, "Look, Samuel, you cannot maintain this. You've got to get out of this. And the way to get out of this is go down to Bethlehem. This is where I have the man that I've been telling you about, the man that is after my own heart. This is where you're going to find him. You go down to Bethlehem and you're going to find out of the house of Jesse the man that I want you to anoint as the second king of Israel." Now, when Samuel makes his way to Bethlehem, how is he received by the elders of the city? All right. Why are the elders of Bethlehem afraid of Samuel's arrival? I'm sorry, say it again, Greg. All right, so everything that had transpired in 1 Samuel chapter 15, had that just been maintained between Saul and Samuel? Nobody else apparently heard about it? Or it seems like others had heard that Samuel has just pretty much rebuked the king their own non-speaking terms. I mean, chapter 15 ends with Samuel, or it being said that Samuel does not see Saul again. So this is pretty well known, and when Samuel arrives in Bethlehem, these elders come out, "Well, why are you here? What's going on? What's going to happen?" So they're fearful for even their own selves. So Samuel arrives, and I love verse 6. I love verse 6. Because when Samuel arrives at the house of Jesse, what happens in verse 6?
He sees his firstborn, his oldest son, and just assumes that's going
to be. All right. So the eldest son, Eliab, comes in, and as soon as Eliab walks through the door, it's like Samuel's like, this is it. This is it. Had they gotten in trouble about that in the past? Why did they pick Saul? His stature. It was the appearance. He looked right. But then in verse 7, God's going to correct this. Someone read 1 Samuel chapter 16 in verse 7. 1 Samuel chapter 16 in verse 7.
But the Lord said to Samuel, do not look at his appearance or his physical stature, because I have refused him. For the Lord does not see as man sees. For man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart.
All right, so the Lord is looking to what? He's not looking at the outward. That doesn't matter to God. Because it doesn't matter that you need... Do you have to have all the muscles in the world to be victorious if you follow God? You don't. All you have to have is trust in the Lord. And that's what David's going to have. That's the type of heart of David. And that's what God is calling for. So then you have the parade of sons. The seven sons are all brought before Samuel. Just one after another, after another, after another. And can you imagine trying to think about this in the mindset of Samuel? What are some things that we know about Samuel, especially by the time we get to this point in 1 Samuel chapter 16? What had he already failed to do with his own two sons? Convict them. And to have them, because what was Samuel wanting to do seemingly at the beginning of this? And going all the way back to 1 Samuel chapter 7, he's just wanting to hand the mantle over to who? His sons. And already, what do we know about Samuel in 1 Samuel 7 and 8? He's an old man. So Samuel fails in that. Then Samuel turns and he anoints Saul, and then that becomes an utter failure by chapter 15. So now Samuel is an extremely old individual. And here God has brought him to the house of Jesse. And Jesse has brought forth seven sons, beginning with Eliab down to the seventh. And you're thinking, well, certainly in one of those, Samuel's thinking, well, this has got to be a no. Okay, well, then he's got to be a no. Do you think Samuel may have at this time started to possibly just, what's going on? You know, here I am, an old man. I'm trying to protect the nation. I'm trying to protect the kingdom. And I just don't understand how all of this is going to work out. So Samuel finally asked Jesse a question. What did he ask? Do you have any more sons? And where was the final son? Feeding, tending the sheep. Turn over with me real quick to 2 Samuel chapter 7. 2 Samuel chapter 7. Brent, if you don't mind reading verse 8. 2 Samuel chapter 7 and verse 8.
Now therefore, thus you shall say to my servant David, thus says the Lord of hosts, I took you from the pasture, from following the sheep, to be ruler over my people Israel.
All right. What can we not miss then out of 1 Samuel chapter 16? What's something that we need to hold on to when we look at David when he's first introduced to us in the narrative?
Shepherd.
He's a shepherd. And that is crucial. It's crucial because it's going to come back up in chapter 17. But it's crucial because that's the relationship that God desires for his king. God desires his king to be a shepherd. Now, how had Saul been leading the people and leading the nation? Fear. He was a driver. But God wanted his people to be seen as the sheep that they were. He wanted a shepherd. He wanted somebody that would lead them from the front, not from the and driving them from the back. So this is something that we need to take hold of at the very instance here with the introduction to this character, David. Now, in verse 13 it says, let's look at how he appears. So in verse 12, so he sent and brought him in. Now he was ruddy with beautiful eyes and a handsome appearance. How many of you know what that word ruddy means? All right, somebody said it.
Reddish.
So essentially what you need to think about with David is somebody that looked like me. I've been waiting all week to say that. Yeah. I appreciate that, Greg. That was Greg Richardson. You cut me down pretty good there. If somebody could come get the knife out of my back. All right, but ruddy. You think about the description of Saul. He was head and shoulders above. But here you have this young lad, and we're going to talk about his age possibly in the next chapter more. But here you have somebody very young, but already he has the appeal. He has, when I think about this, beautiful eyes and handsome appearance, the idea is that he just attracts people. How many of you have ever had one of those individuals in your life where just seemingly every time this individual walked into a room, it's just like, and it's not because of the person, it's himself or herself, it's just who they are, people are just attracted to them. They either get people talking to them or something like that. That's the charisma that I see with David as he's introduced to us here in verse 12. And then in verse 13, Samuel takes the horn of oil, anoints him in the midst of his brothers, and the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon David from that day forward, and Samuel arose and went to Ramah. So Samuel goes back to his hometown from this point. Now, what's interesting there in verse 13 is who is present to the anointing of David? His brothers. But in chapter 17, does it seem like the brothers have just, they've completely done what? They just completely overlooked this fact and they just ignored it completely.
Do they have any idea what this anointing was about, though?
And that's the truth, too. They're kind of on the out. They're like, why is this? Now, would they have known who Samuel is? I think they would have, because, I mean, even the elders of Bethlehem knew who he was. He's there on the Lord's business. And I think some of these things, but still, at the end of the day, older brothers do not want to see younger brothers do what? Rise above them. I think there's another biblical narrative that's kind of in the same lines, right? He had a couple of dreams. Joseph. It's very similar here, isn't it? Now, it's not 12 like it is back with Joseph, but it's very similar where the older brothers just do not want to accept. And that's kind of the play that I see here. Now, the next question is, what seems to happen simultaneously to David and to Saul, and then who was brought to comfort Saul? Now, I've already read what happens to David. David is anointed, and immediately what comes upon him? Spirit of the Lord. Okay, whenever we see the Spirit of the Lord coming mightily upon somebody, that is the Lord's sign that this is the man I have chosen. Again, this is a sign that we see throughout the period of the Judges. This is how God signifies that he has chosen this individual. The Spirit of the Lord comes mightily upon David, and then in verse 14, something happens. All right, so the Spirit of the Lord is taken from Saul, goes to David, but then what is given to Saul? Distressing spirit. What's another thing that y'all may have there? An evil spirit. So let's just ask the question. What does that mean? All right. Yeah, hatred.
Well, something that this is probably the first recorded case of that illness.
All right.
Seriously.
No.
That's what they think. That's why he was on the bed to calm down. And they were playing for him. And I don't know
Now, certainly Saul is dealing with something mentally. I mean, there's no argument. I don't think anybody who reads the text would disagree that Saul's dealing with something here that seems a little bit more extraordinary than others.
The reason I say that, too, is he has a lot of... He reads the text all the way through about Saul. He has a lot of characteristics of people we call by hope.
Mm-hmm.
How he can be fine one minute and turn on a dime. Mm-hmm. It kind of fits what we call that. I don't know if it's related or not.
And we definitely see that in Saul, where one second he's comforted by David playing, the next second he's grabbing up his spear and throwing it at him, as we read last week in chapters 18 and 19.
The servant recognizes there in verse 15 as a troubling or a distressing spirit.
All right, troubling, an evil spirit, a distressing spirit. So the Lord has done this. So there's some difficulty, and I'll be honest with you guys. I've read through multiple things in just trying to understand a little bit myself. I even texted a couple of friends and said, hey, what do y'all think about this? How would y'all explain it? And of course, everybody came back with about three different things or three different ideas. But typically, when we look at the evil spirits in the Old Testament, first, we're not talking about demon possession here. We're not talking about a demon possession. And one of the reasons we know that we're not talking about demon possession is because if we look at demon possession in the New Testament sense, when demons possessed those individuals in the New Testament, what free will did that person have when the demon was possessing them? Zero. The demon would throw my son in the water to drown him or throw him in the fire to burn him, as that one father asked for Jesus to drive out the demon. So we're not talking about some demon possession. I don't believe we're talking about that. Is this that God sent the spirit? Or is it that God allowed a spirit to come upon Saul?
The evil spirit came from God, says verse 16.
Well, and the question is it came from God? The words there could mean, possibly mean that God allowed this to happen to Saul. So that, yes, there is a realm outside of our human eyesight and outside of our physical realm that exists even to this day. And in that realm, there is a time in where, I guess my battery may have been, yes. So during that time, you know, I guess I may have to step back. So it could be something in a spiritual realm or in the spiritual nature. A couple of things that I found. Bob Waldron, in his commentary set that he wrote for True Commentaries, he said this: what Saul has was not demon possession, but a demon or an evil spirit was involved. The evil spirit that plagued Saul is not evidence of a widespread phenomenon, but was a specific case in which God used the evil spirit to afflict and punish Saul. The evil spirit not only brought on severe depression and paranoia, but also caused Saul to make utterances, but these utterances did not involve revelations. And I probably would side with Bob there. Bob knows a little bit more about the Hebrew and a whole lot more about the Bible than I do. Yes, ma'am.
It's a Native American story or whatever, myth, whatever you want to call it, that inside each person are two dogs. A good one and a bad one. Mm-hmm. And they ask which one wins. Well, the one who beats the most. And that's mm-hmm. basically what Saul's doing. He's feeding into this. He was anointed king, and he has this great kingdom, and he was the chosen one, and then it was this whole thing's going to be gone, yet he was still king.
Mm-hmm.
And still having to do that job as a king, but he knew it wasn't going to last. So those times he just kept feeding that bad side.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right, two things that I want you to see here, and then we're going to have to move on because chapter 17 is a huge one. All right, chapter 16, look at verse 18, because I want you to see how David is mentioned here. Behold, I have seen a son of Jesse the Bethlehemite, who was a skillful musician, a mighty man of valor, a warrior, one prudent in speech, and a handsome man, and the Lord is with him. Now, what's interesting about that description of David in chapter 16? How do we know anything about him being a mighty man of valor or a man of warrior in chapter 16? Chapter 17 chronologically hasn't occurred yet, right? Alright, we're gonna talk about some of this. But then the next verse, verse 21, this is key. This is key. Going back to what we studied last week, where Saul's hatred for David began is because in chapter 18, you remember, Jonathan loved David. All the people of Israel loved David. Michael, his daughter, loved David. Look at verse 21 of chapter 16. Who loved David first? Saul. Saul did.
Loved him greatly.
Loved him greatly. And that's just that's something that you need to take note of. That relationship began on great premises, a great foundation. Now, of course, it goes vastly different there from that point on. All right, somebody describe to me Goliath. Big. He's a giant.
He's a bully.
He was a bully. A bully.
Have you seen the description of the murderer that's escaped that deputy?
6 foot six?
6'9".
Oh, 6'9".
6'9" and 300 pounds. He's a big man. But he's not compared to Goliath.
Not so. How tall approximately would Goliath be?
9.5, 9'10",
something like that. That's kind of crazy to think about. I would pick him for our basketball team, and then Oglesby would never win again. Yes, ma'am.
At camp, Russell Youth Camp, one of the younger teachers of the little kids drew out a Goliath that high. Put it up at the top of the building, and it was amazing.
That's one of those things, I think, especially as a kid, but even as an adult, when we see that height, I mean, to think of somebody 10 foot tall walking toward me, I'm out. Now, what else do we know about Goliath? First, what is his hometown? Gath. And we're going to look at a map, I believe it's after this, and we're going to look at all of these places on the map so we can know everything and at least see it that way. But now let's talk about Goliath in the sense of what he's wearing. All right. So he's got his bronze helmet. He's got his scale armor. You had 200 pounds. I had a little bit less than that.
Then he's got a spear with like 2 to 4 to 25 pounds
head. All right. He's a man. He's a man's man. I mean, if he's wearing 125 is what I had, up to 200 pounds worth of armor, and he's just casually walking in that, I mean, I don't think he's struggling to be able to carry the armor. He has this weaver's beam as a spear with a head on it that's at least 15 to 25 pounds. And how many of your dads taught you the right way when you pick up the sledgehammer, you're supposed to play that game where you hold it out? John knows what I'm talking about. How many of y'all done that? You hold it way out here, and you see if you can touch your nose with it, you know? How many of you almost broke your nose or almost hurt yourself severely doing that? And that's what, a 5 pound, 7 pound? You know, not a heavy at all. Here's a 25 pound. I mean, this dude is massive, but even beyond that, he's not even able to carry his own what? He needs another man to walk before him to carry his shield for him. So that's all of his physical things. But now let's think about Goliath, and what does he? He's a bully. As I can't remember which one said it. Miss Beth said it. He's a bully. He's coming out before the lines of battle, and he's saying essentially what? All right. If you send somebody down here to fight, if he beats me, we'll do what? He's a liar, right? Goliath's a liar. Because that's not what the Philistines did. A little bit later in this chapter, that's not what the Philistines did. But then if I beat him, you will become our slaves. You'll become our servants. And then he doesn't just talk to them physically, but what does he taunt? What does he really go after? He goes after their God. Again, you look at him, how tall he is. And then, out of all the camp of Israel, who should have been the one that would have at least been seen at the front lines listening? But where do you find Saul? Essentially, he's back in his tent hiding. Where did we find him when he was, you know, supposed to be anointed king, hiding amongst the baggage? And even here, he's not there. And you look at verse 11, when Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistines, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. I think if you were to go back and read the narrative, read everything from specifically Numbers onward, I wonder how many times dismayed, do not be dismayed or afraid, is used as God speaks to Israel. Do not be afraid, do not be dismayed, because God says it continuously to them. But here they've lost it. All right. Verse 12. Now we're getting kind of, okay, here's our battle. Gath is here. This is the valley of Elah, the brook that would have traveled all the way through. Now, we've already been to Adullam. There's the caves of Adullam. That's where David goes at the end of 1 Samuel chapter 19, I believe. It's in between Azekah and Socah. The Philistines here, the Israelites are here. So we're going to be at this point on the map for the next at least tonight. All right, what did David's first words symbolize about him? Now first, chapter 7, verses 12 through 15, David is kind of given an introduction again. And we're told a little bit about him, a little bit about his father and about his family, where he's from. And why do we need that? Because we just read chapter 16, right? But yet this is leading up to something. This is something that's happening inside the narrative.
Hey, Cole,
yes, sir.
Something that goes along in this story that you see time and time again in mankind is it's very simple to follow the crowd, whether it be to follow God or to follow man or to follow Satan. Mm-hmm. I'd say the fear of unpopularity or the fear of retribution, the fear of whatever it is, to stand up for what is right or what you believe is right sometimes takes more than what most people have, and they're happy to be followers. But to be a servant of God, you have to stand against, at times, your king.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying Christ is our king. I'm saying against your government or against even sometimes need to be willing to question people in the Lord's church and make sure that their foundation is secure as you study through the scripture. And we shouldn't be afraid of that challenge, because God certainly isn't afraid of us challenging his word.
Absolutely.
Just as Job did. When he challenged, he found out that God had the wisdom and God had the ability to deliver us from whatever situation. We sometimes, and I would say at some point, we all fail to our own weakness.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a great application of what David is going to materialize for us literally in this chapter, and how we need that same mental attitude. Look at verse 16. How long had Goliath been doing this? 40 days. Remember, 40 days. 40 is always the number of trial and tribulation. Always. Every time you see 40 days or 40 in the Bible, it's always trial and tribulation. That's what we see here again. All right, so David comes into the camp. Now, I love this about David. When David comes into the camp, he drops off the what and then goes to his brothers. He drops off the food. He drops off the baggage with the baggage collector, the baggage keeper. He doesn't stay there. That's where Saul was found. David doesn't stay there. David goes and finds his brother. Then in verses 24 and 25, we have the camp is again, fear is creeping through the camp. And finally somebody says, okay, well Saul's going to have to up the ante. If one of us is going to go out here and battle against Goliath, Saul needs to give us something. So what Saul needs to give us is riches, a woman, and freedom. That's what we need from Saul. And then we have David's first words. Someone read verses 26, or verse 26.
Then David spoke to the men who were standing by him, What will be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should taunt the armies of the living God?
All right. Now, David's first question was answered where? Preceding verse. So we already know the answer to that. But what does David's words here symbolize about him? He trusts in God. And who is he? Who is his zeal for here? Who is he jealous for? He's jealous for the Lord and on the Lord's behalf. Who is this uncircumcised Philistine? Now remember, and the reason I'm asking this question, because we go back to Saul. You remember what Saul's first questions, what the first words indicated? He was all this anxious, the anxiety. My father's going to be worried about us. He's worried about the physical things. David's worried about the Lord. He's worried about the Lord being fought for.
Yeah, but remember, Saul no longer has the spirit of the Lord.
Yes.
David's king. And David has no fear since he has the spirit of God in him. And we don't complain about a young lad, but he's still a mighty man of valor.
Yes. Well, we're going to come to that. I got to move to get there, but we're going to hopefully get to that. All right, how does Eliab respond to his little brother? He needs to hush up. He needs to stop talking. Well, David doesn't stop talking. The words finally get to whose house? Whose tent? Saul finally finds out. So Saul finally brings David to him. And when Saul begins to question David, he says, look, you know, Goliath has been a warrior since his youth. And here you are but a youth. Now, what's something that we can know specifically about David at this point that tells us his age?
He couldn't wear Saul's.
Well, he couldn't wear Saul's armor. Which that makes sense, doesn't it? Saul's head and, you know, head and shoulders above the rest. I'm sure his armor was bigger than everybody else's. But what do we know about David's age here? How old do you have to be to fight in the armies of Israel? At least 20. David's not fighting in the armies of Israel yet. So he's not 20. He's got to be less than that. Now, the typical agreement, or at least what I saw, was around 16 to 18 years old. Now, how many 16 to 18 year olds are we entrusting with the future of our kingdom?
Every one of them.
Well, it's a blind just, here you go. But you see what I'm saying?
But remember what you said about Saul. His hands and shoulders above. Next time this young guy, he just didn't go do it for
me. Absolutely.
So verse 15, chapter 17, gives me the indication, this was not David's first visit to the battlefield. And whether or not he was fighting or not, I don't know, because verse 15 says, David occasionally went and returned from Saul. So he was there, and he went back to feed the father's sheep. So I don't know if he's still the youth that's not fighting, or whether he's going from the battlefield back to his family.
I typically saw in verse 15 back to chapter 16, Saul's tormented, David's being brought for a specific reason, not just for the provisions. That's the way I've read it. Brother Dan, did you have something? And that's true too. Very true. All right. But David, he's finally, Saul's, you know, questioning, you know, how are you going to do this? What is David's reliance? What does he rely upon? And what example does he give of that reliance?
He took off the armor that Saul was putting on his armor. He said, I don't need this. I have God on my side.
All right. I have God on my side. And what two examples specifically?
The bear and the lion.
You see, Saul, I'm a shepherd. And when you're out in the field and you're tending your flock, you have to protect them from what? You have to, wild animals that come in the midst. And specifically, David says, and a bear came upon us and a lion came upon us, and what did I do to them? And the same God who delivered the bear and the lion into my hand is the same God who will deliver this uncircumcised Philistine into my hand this day. So David immediately is that reliance upon God here, and no fear whatsoever as he is approaching Goliath. All right. That may have been... Okay. So David's now making his approach toward the battlefield. What does he have? He has a shepherd's staff, a sling, and he bent down and he picked up what? Five stones. Brother Floyd, why did he pick up five? We don't know. What's a possibility? Goliath had what? Goliath had four other brothers. Is it possible? Is it possible? Okay, maybe. I don't know. Other than he picks up five stones and he puts them in his pocket. Now, as he approaches Goliath again, the bully is represented here. How does Goliath react to this young boy coming at him? What is this? This is your great champion? Look at who I am. Look at my stature. Look at all that I have. And you're sending this out to me? Well, I'm going to feed your flesh to the birds of the sky. How does David respond to Goliath? Someone read verses 45 through 47.
Then David said to the Philistine, "You come to me with a sword, with a spear, and a javelin. But I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you and take your head from you. And this day I will give the carcasses of to the birds of the air and the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. Then all this assembly shall know that the Lord does not save with sword and spear, but the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands."
All right. Utter and complete reliance upon who? God. Now, does David go in with nothing? No, he still goes in with a very good weapon. And it was probably a weapon that he was very good using. It seems to be, because he takes one stone, he slings it, and where does he hit Goliath?
I'll take the same weapon he took down the bear and the lion with.
He has some talent with this. He's used it before. And as such, he takes Goliath down. There is no sword. He takes whose sword? Goliath's own sword. He chops off his head. And then can you imagine? I mean, try to envision in your mind this 9-foot-tall, 10-foot-tall guy hitting the earth and the thunder that must have been like. And then the Philistines just looking out there going, "What in the world?" And you watch this little boy in your eyes take his sword, cut off his head. And you're like, okay, it's time to get out of Dodge. And they begin to run. They run all the way back to Gath and then up north to Ekron. They run away from the Israelites. But yet, because of David and what he's done that day, the fear, the doubt that was in the camp of Israel has been vanquished. Now what did the Israelite camp do to the Philistines? Did they just let them run? They pursued them and killed them. They did exactly as David said that they were going to do. All right, so David prevails over the Philistine. David's not fearful.
Verse 48 is interesting too. When David met Goliath, he ran.
Absolutely. Absolutely. He doesn't back away. He's not scared. He's running to meet the competitor. All right, now we come to the end of the chapter, verses 55 through 58. This is interesting. This is difficult. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. What seems to happen in verses 55 and 56 is that there's a time stamp that's happening here. Now David going out against the Philistines. So it's not after the victory, but as he's going out, it's almost like we're going back in the same chapter, back to about verse 40. Is when Saul is asking Abner this question. And then it says, so when David returned, now we come back to the present tense. Now we come back to David has now come back to the camp. And as he has come back to the camp, Abner has grabbed him up and is bringing him to Saul. And Saul says, whose son are you, young man? And David answered, I am the son of your servant Jesse, the Bethlehemite. What confusion could be found there, right? Does anybody have an explanation? Does anybody have an idea? Why is this? What's going on here at the end of chapter 17? Well, and we've seen that. I mean, I'm sure that each of you as parents, and I'm starting to see it more and more with my oldest, you know, as he's turned 13, he doesn't look like the little boy anymore, right? He's changing in my eyes. So that may be playing into the part a little bit.
Well, how long had David been playing the harp? You know, what's the time period between the end of 16 and 17? I mean, is it just a very brief time? It seems that the end of 16 covers a much more time than just a short time before chapter 17.
All right. Dan?
Yeah. In some ways, I don't have any problems with this because Saul was very prideful, egotistical. This is just a guy who comes in to make him feel better and plays the harp. He doesn't have to know anything about it. He's the harp.
Mm-hmm.
Now all of a sudden he finds out, oh, he can fight this giant. He has promised that your father will not have to pay taxes. So he's kind of making good on this. He's like, okay, who's that harp? You know, who's your dad? I'm going to have to make sure your family doesn't pay taxes. And by the way, you can't go home anymore. I need you here. Where before he'd been going back and forth to help with the sheep.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't have any problems with the time frame.
And that's probably more of where I'm at after journeying through everything. One position just said that, you know, really what we have here in 1 Samuel 16 and 17 is very akin to Genesis 1 and 2. What does Genesis 1 teach us?
Creation.
The days of creation. What does Genesis 2 teach us? It's just a further explanation of day six. It's just a and really that possibly could be what's going on here, is that the narrator, the writer, is just giving us a little bit more and more and more to the whole picture of what's happening. And that brings us to our research question. And the research question is what specifically do we learn about David in these two chapters? Well, first, let me ask you this. How do the Israelites remember King David? They remember King David in two ways, typically. Go back to chapter 16.
He's a king of war.
All right, he is a king of war. That's one. What's the other? Not a mighty man of valor. He's the warrior. He's the battle king. Yes. What is he doing in chapter 16? What is David presented doing in chapter 16? And what does he do? What he writes hundreds of them. He's a musician. David's known for being a musician, and David's known for being a mighty man of valor, a warrior. And what does 1 Samuel 16 and 1 Samuel 17 do? It introduces to us this new character that we've not seen before in the text. And in chapter 16, it introduces him as the musician. And in chapter 17, it introduces him as the great warrior. Exactly who he would be for all the ages. All right. Any comments, questions, thoughts?
Thank you. With Saul and David, you're both destructible because they call Saul choice and head and shoulders above the rest. And
spiritual being, you know, in Isaiah it says, yes, there's no beauty that we should desire it. And it makes a contrast in what man looks for and what God looks for.
Absolutely. And if you don't make that contrast, I would strongly recommend go read Isaiah, the end of Isaiah 52 and Isaiah 53 tonight to look at our spiritual. Absolutely. Thank you so much, everybody, for your